All right. Good morning, everyone. It's 9:34. It's Wednesday, October 9th, 2019. I'm Commissioner Brian Crashes, joined by Commissioner Julie Fedorchak and Commissioner Randy Chrisman. This is a wind industry. It's going to be the plan, I believe, is to make it into a semi-annual meeting. So this is the first one. We've met with other industry groups, different segments of development in North Dakota. So we get updates from them. And Levi actually broached the idea. And I got a call, and then you worked with me a little bit, and then you worked with Julie, and good to have you all here. So I don't know how formal. I mean, someone mentioned this is going to be pretty informal. Or I think it was a question or probably a hope. And it is. It is, in my opinion. So we'll see what direction it goes. But Julie, do you just want to take it from here? I don't know if we want to go around and have everyone introduce themselves. And
I think we should. Maybe we'll just do commission staff. Everyone can introduce themselves from our side, and then we can pass the microphones around, and everyone in the room can at least say who they are and who they're here on behalf of. So I'm Julie Fedorchak, a commissioner at the PSC, and I've been here since January 1st of 20, or is it second, Randy? 2013. One day less than Randy. So these distinctions are important. So go ahead, Randy.
Randy Chrisman, I've been here one day more than Julie.
He's so much smarter, too.
We learned a lot that day, too, because it was a holiday. But one thing I just wanted to point out, you know, because as was mentioned, I think this sort of is a spin-off to what's been done probably for a long time with coal and a lesser time with oil and gas. But they're more used to it. And so just something that might be new to some of you, we can't deal in this with things involved in open cases. So, you know, please refrain from that. It wouldn't be fair to the other side for us to get into those cases. So if you're not experienced with that, think of it similar to some open court case or something that you wouldn't expect the judge to have an ex parte discussion. So just wanted to point that out to everyone. That might be something relatively new. Other than that, I just look forward to an informal kind of a discussion. I think that that lends itself to learning better for us than in more formal atmospheres. So looking forward to the morning.
Brian Johnson, I'm a staff attorney for the PSC.
John Hsu, PSC staff.
Victor Shook with commission staff.
And we have some more staff back here. Do you guys want to introduce yourselves to this panel?
Adam Renfant, staff. Jerry Leanne with staff.
Okay.
Perry Oberg, NextEra Energy.
Clay Cameron, NextEra Energy.
Julie Vogt, NextEra Energy. Ooh.
Casey Fury with Crowley Fleck, local counsel for NextEra.
Dustin Jones with NextEra.
Jeff Price with NextEra Energy.
Shane Gettle with Odney on behalf of NextEra here today.
Dave Nearing, North Dakota Vision Keepers.
Steve Gotino with the Labor and Deaths Union of North America.
Pam Link, Labor's International Union of North America.
I'm Amy Sisk with the Bismarck Tribune. Yeah, that can go back at the table, I think. Thanks, Amy.
Brenda Gunderson with Apex Clean Energy.
Ryan Henning, Apex Clean Energy.
Chris Kunkel with Apex Clean Energy.
Beth Soholt with Clean Grid Alliance.
Jeff Danielson, the Central Region Director for the American Wind Energy Association and an alumni of the University of Northern Iowa Panthers, so it's good to be in North Dakota.
Good morning, everyone. Levi Antris with GA Group PC here in Bismarck on behalf of wind or wind industry of North Dakota. I just wanted to formally say thank you for the opportunity for the group to get together. Wind is essentially an informal coalition that's spearheading this meeting with you all, and it's an informal coalition of companies and including AWEA, Apex, Capital Power EDF, NL Green Power North America, and NextEra.
Jonathan Wilson, Capital Power.
Bob Evans, Capital Power.
Andrew Dallin, EDF Renewables.
Jonathan Gray with NL Green Power.
Kayla Efforts-Cleveland from Olson Efforts on behalf of NL Green Power.
Amy Lundy with GA Group and Wind.
Peter Mavis with Clean Grid Alliance.
Patrick Vaughn with the Public Service Commission staff.
Very good. Thanks, everybody. Do you want me to work through the agenda?
Yeah.
Okay. So thank you. I really appreciate this. Like my colleagues said, that these meetings have been very productive with the other industries that we are involved with on a regular basis. So I think it was a great idea, Levi, to get this rolling and give us an opportunity to talk about some of the bigger issues in a more informal setting when there isn't something right on the line, like a case and a decision. So very good. And there's been a lot of activity in North Dakota with wind in the last couple legislative sessions and in the last decade just in general. So it's front and center for a lot of people in the state. I hear people asking about it, just everyday citizens, all the time when I'm out and about. People are extremely interested and engaged in this industry and its development and how it impacts our state, both in very positive ways and in ways that some people don't like. So I think that's the case with any energy form. There's lovers and haters, so it's no different. So I think that we'll just move through the agenda. The first item was legislative outcomes implementation. And so there's a couple things that passed in the last legislative session. And I think that the idea here was for us to kind of talk about some of those things and what's happening here.
Yep.
So the biggest, well, the first one that I'd address is the, there was so much back and forth on the issue of, it ended up as the agencies that are providing input to the commission cannot provide input any later than 30 days prior to the hearing. And that took very many different iterations through the session, and that's where we landed on that one. And so from our perspective, initially I thought we should create some rules for that in terms of what does that mean then for you guys and what does it mean for everybody else who's involved. And we've had those discussions with, we did have some industry discussions just in general prior to the session, maybe it was during the session, I can't remember the time, but about siting and how to improve some of the processes. And this was one of them too that everyone seemed frustrated with, like how do we get feedback in a timely manner? And how do we get the feedback in a timely manner? So I think this could be actually a nice way to deal with this. What I'm envisioning, we don't have any formal rule process in conversations with staff. I think the thought would be to deal with it on a case-by-case basis, at least for starters. We haven't had any applications since this law went into effect, but we're anticipating some here in the not-too-distant future. And so we have, in the past, had some of our when we declare the application complete and set the hearing date, sometimes the companies don't have all the studies done, and we've set the date contingent on receiving studies prior to whatever, 2 weeks before. We've set a number of different time frames. So I think what I envision doing is something kind of similar to that, only we would say it will be tougher to set the hearing. I will just say it'll be tougher to set the hearing without the studies complete. That's going to be very difficult because if we don't have the studies and nobody else has the studies, and if they're supposed to have their feedback in 30 days prior to the hearing, then how far in advance would we be setting the hearing dates? So I think note number one is make sure your studies are done and complete so that we can set a hearing at a reasonable time. So if you've got all your studies in, I think what I would envision is requiring that even if you don't, whatever, everything has to be in 60 days prior to the hearing so that any interested parties would have time to 30 days to review and respond and have their input in 30 days prior to the hearing. So it just provides some more certain dates for how input is provided and accessed prior to the hearing. I think it'll probably be a good change for us because it is frustrating to get up to the last minute a lot of changes prior to hearings on projects. And I think we'll see how it works for industry because I appreciate the fact these are complicated projects. There are a lot of moving parts and things change. So that, you know, may create some challenges for you all in making sure that you are providing the final information in time for the people to provide their information in accordance with the law, which is 30 days prior to the hearing. So that's how I view it. I don't know how you guys see things. It's not something we've had to deal with yet, so it's still sort of a work in progress and subject to change as we move forward, but that's the way that I see that being implemented, at least initially.
Yeah. Now, the 30 days is really important. Of course, any company that comes in with a siting application, for example, or whether it's an ADP, but a siting application in particular, you want to know that it's been looked at fairly and objectively. And we oftentimes, almost always, actually, I don't know when, since I've been here for what, almost 3 years, not had multiple cases at the same time. You know, you've got a pipeline hearing coming up. You're preparing for that. ADPs, rate cases, you name it, and staff knows all too well because they're scrambling, too. And we've got a small staff. We're one of the most efficient, and I would also say effective. We have one of the most efficient and effective staffs in terms of all the regulatory agencies across the country, without question. And they're really good at what they do, but you think, okay, well, you know, it's still 2 weeks before the trial. We might be buried in something else. So that time is critical. And then you know that you've had our full attention. We've been able to review the information appropriately. So very important.
I would just add, Julie pointed out that it may be tougher to get everything in that far in advance. But I think it's going to prove some benefits, certainly for us, certainly for people, the public, come to the hearings, but I think for the companies too, because when everything gets filed last minute, we've had something. Now we get to the hearing, and it's all different, and so we have different binders, different files. How's the public supposed to follow that? And so, and then also any agencies then file things late, and then the company needs to respond late. And so getting it all out, I think, will make better hearings and might actually expedite the process of reaching a final decision from the time of the hearing going forward because it was all done in advance and other agencies had a chance to comment on the actual application, not the one that preceded the actual application. So I think, you know, can end up being good for everybody, probably.
Okay. Does anybody, before we move off of that one, what do you guys think about that? What are your initial thoughts on?
Is this something, Commissioner, that you said you'd want to put in rules or you'd want to see done as just an industry best practice?
No, we'll put it in our the motion that declares that the application is complete and we set the hearing date. And
okay.
So we'll put it in there for starters and see how it goes. And then we'll have some experience with it down the road. If we want to make it, you know, a formal rule, we can move to that at that point. But I guess just you'd see it at the time, but just as a heads up, I think that's how it would be dealt with initially. So does anyone have huge issues? If you do, as you leave and think about it a little bit more, if you have issues that you think we should be thinking about that, you know, might be problematic as it relates to that proposed mm-hmm. way to handle it, let us know. But that's what you can anticipate, at least on the first one. Okay.
I just want to add one thing, because we haven't had rulemaking or anything where we've talked about it. I'm just speaking for myself here, but, you know, I get that sometimes something can be found from that point going forward, and maybe a turbine site is going to be moved 20 feet or something. I don't know that that completely changes everything. But we've had some hearings where the day of the hearing, you hardly recognize this application. And with dramatic wholesale changes when other agencies were required to file their comments 30 days in advance, and now they really are almost meaningless, I don't know that it, in my mind, would leave us any choice but to just cancel the hearing and reschedule and start the process all over again. So I do think that this is going to end up being a pretty significant deadline that can't be changed dramatically to have the information in so that people can comment.
Okay, good. And hopefully, I just see a lot of benefits through the whole system that I think this will create. So while initially I thought this might be problematic, as the months have passed since the session, I've settled down and I think more clearly, and I think it's going to work. So we'll see how things, how it does, and we can always adjust. So, okay, the other big issue was this issue of indirect payments. Jack, do you want to explain what actually happened in the end on that that issue? Not to put you on the spot, but
legislatively?
Yeah.
To my knowledge, I'm trying to even recall, and I'm sorry. I'm trying to think back at what did occur during the last legislative session.
Jack, if I could, Commissioner.
Yes, please.
It was amendment to the Siting Act that said the commission cannot condition the issuance of a certificate or permit on the applicant providing mitigation payment assessor requested by an agency or entity to offset negative wildlife impacts.
That's right. And as I recall, I remember we had this pretty broad discussion about this and how we thought this was ultimately going to change how we operate under the Siting Act during that time period. And I think we ultimately decided that it really doesn't affect us at all, since that it was not something that prior to that day that we really had done.
Right.
Anyways.
Yeah, we didn't have an issue with that because we haven't done that, and we don't view it as being something we can do. That's not to say that there weren't payments negotiated and provided. It's just that they weren't required by us. And so that issue, I think, maybe clarified it for folks who were concerned that that was something that was happening, or that was concerned that we could do that, or I don't know. But hopefully that doesn't really change how we view things and how we work.
Yeah, I don't think there's any question that there was some confusion by some of the legislators, to be really honest, on the Foxtail order, because I had a number of them, and it wasn't like the majority, but I had several of them came up to me and said, but you made them do it in the Foxtail order. And I pointed out to them that it was just noted that a voluntary agreement was being worked on between Game and Fish and the developer, and that's really all it said. And it even, you know, as the language was written, indicated that it was still being discussed. So it wasn't like a specific requirement with specific numbers or whatever. I applaud any company for being a good corporate citizen in that respect, but the legislative body, I think, misinterpreted that, and I shouldn't say legislative body, but some legislators did, and then that drove a narrative that Well, now the PSC is making them do this.
The Commissioner, the Wind Coalition itself, they were neutral on both of the bills as they were coming through. I think there's various company perspectives, which hopefully you'll hear from some of them. But the public policy position of the Wind Coalition was, let's be sure the Siting Act doesn't constrain voluntary solutions, essentially, yeah. Or not. I mean, essentially leave it up to the freedom of, developers to pursue and develop how they see fit. Mm-hmm. And to that end, like I said, we're neutral on both of the bills and all the iterations that ultimately came through.
I think that was really important because the one thing that's helpful with the siting law that I see is the flexibility. And the more you start prescribing what can and cannot happen, it takes away the flexibility. And there's so many different situations that you sometimes can anticipate, but you can't always anticipate, and you'd hate to curtail a solution that could be developed between parties on something that had never been considered because you just went a little too far with the prescriptions in law. So I think that this preserves that flexibility. So does anyone have any thoughts or comments or issues that they'd like to discuss as it relates to that? Speak now. Speak now. All right.
And I think that really needs to be emphasized throughout this. This isn't just like, I mean, we could have sent our thoughts out, I suppose, in an email. You wouldn't know you had to come. We're wanting to hear from you. So if you have thoughts on these things,
yeah,
this is what we're here for. So.
Green is on.
Okay, thank you. Julie Volk, next.
Julie, it doesn't have to be real close if it's...
Okay. Can you guys hear me here?
Foot or foot and a half away from...
Okay. Thanks. Thank you for the training on the microphone. Julie Volk with NextEra. I just wanted to comment to reiterate some of the confusion with the Foxtail project. That was a project that we had developed, and as part of that, we did put together a mitigation package, part of which included a financial aspect, but that was not something that was directed by the PSC. That's something that we did voluntarily as a company, and we appreciate that we had the flexibility to do that, and I think that's something that is part of development when we're looking at projects. What are all of our options? What can we do to have tools to work through things? So just wanted to reiterate that is how we viewed that as well.
Thanks, Julie. And just to add a little bit more color on that piece and to reinforce that, the company's choice as it relates to that project, because that project was so controversial and there were so many allegations to be made about what was and wasn't said, and I went back and listened to the hearing just to make sure that I wasn't misremembering or that I wasn't a lot more awful than I thought I was. And I actually listened to it, and it reinforced what I remembered, which was during the hearing, all of these issues had come up, and there was a lot of discussion about what Game and Fish said and what the company's response was. But it wasn't kind of clear, and it wasn't super point by point. So what I had asked for is, could you please respond in a letter back to us with how you as a company intend to address the concerns, or whether you don't agree with the concerns. Whatever it is, what's your response to the concerns? In the NextEra, experts said, absolutely. In fact, we're almost done with that, so we'll get it to you after the hearing. So when we left that hearing, that's what I expected to receive back, was a filing of here's what the Game and Fish says, here's what we say. So we have a complete record so that, on an appeal or whatever, you look back on the record and say, here's what the expert said, and this is what is there to respond, so it's complete. Instead, we got back from Game and Fish and NextEra that they had come up with this agreement, so the issues were taken care of. Well, that was the company's choice. That's how they wanted to deal with it, and that's what was done. And that was it. And it was over. Again, company choice,
that's what the company decided met their needs. Maybe it was a time issue. Maybe it was who knows what. That was their choice. It addressed the issues of Game and Fish, which is what we cared about, and the issue was over. And then all the, you know, the big kerfluffle happened after that, and here we are. So just so everybody has our perspective on that, and you can go back and listen to it yourself if you'd like. It's kind of interesting to see how mundane it is and what happened as a result. But so I think we're all on the same page with that. And again, I think that we've got a workable solution in law, and hopefully we can move forward in a productive way. Is there any other legislative stuff we should address? I think those were the two big things.
Yep.
Okay. Anybody want to bring up anything legislatively, you guys? All right.
Nope, I think that covers it.
All right. Then I think the lighting update was going to be provided by you folks, so we get to listen to your great progress.
Yeah. So 2017, obviously, the legislature passed the lighting bill. The rulemaking followed, set up two different buckets for when the deadlines for lighting implementation were to be rolled out. I think the idea here is maybe for each company to share their perspective, where they're at. Again, I think if it's an active filing, probably as Commissioner Chrisman can, you know, just be careful that you're not talking about active cases, perhaps. Other than that, we'll going to go around the room and everybody will give a little update.
Yep, and active means not permitted yet. But the
Thank
stuff
you.
That's already permitted, you can talk about.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. Anybody?
Yep. We can start here. Yes, we completed the New Frontier project last year, and we did get approval from the FAA.
For our record, when you start talking, if you'd say your name. So that
I apologize. I'm Bob Evans with Capital Power.
Say that again.
Bob Evans with Capital Power.
Thank you, Bob.
So we did receive all the approval with the FAA, with one of their chosen vendors to install the ADLS system. We're currently installing it and testing it, doing test flights right now. It should be running by the end of the year. It should be operational.
Nice. So. And where's New Frontier? If you could say that, too, because I can't keep track of the locations of all these.
New Frontier is closest to Russo, North
okay.
Dakota, just north of there.
Oh, sure. Yep. Got it.
And
so that's a retrofit, right? That project is running. So
that project is running currently with all the blinking lights.
Yep.
And once we get the ADLS system running, it
and any issues with the Air Force in that one?
Air Force, we had great communication with them. We haven't had an issue. And that was where we were close to a silo area.
Okay.
A missile silo. And
interesting. Huh.
So,
all right.
Which I think we'll discuss later.
Well, yeah, that'll be
yeah.
later. But
yes, but as it relates to the lighting. Okay, thank
yes.
you, Bob.
Before you move on. So that stuff was cited even before I came here, far before Julie came here, even before I came. Are there multiple wind farms there, or is that just one?
So I think there are other wind farms in the area. Capital Power's wind farm is a 99-megawatt facility that reached operation in late 2018, and that's the only –
Oh.
That's the only one we own. I do think there are a few other facilities in
Is
the area.
Right adjacent to it, in that area, kind of from Velva down to Russo?
There's the Russo Wind Farm was sited west of there, and I think there's even another one. I'm not sure the name of that one. So,
not one that's operational.
But that's not owned
one that's
by you.
Just in development stage.
Right. We only own New Frontier, and we have nothing in development in that region at all. Our only site in development is our Garrison Butte wind site, which is very early stage in the Stanton.
But is there another operational wind farm there that was sited way before?
I think there are other operational sites up there, but I don't have any personal knowledge of those.
Okay.
Of, I don't know what they're named or where their specific locations are, just our facility.
Thanks.
Hello, Andrew Dallin with EDF Renewables. And we have one project, the Mercourt project in McIntosh and Dickey counties. That's 150 megawatts under construction right now. And we recently closed on the sale of the project to Otter Tail. So ultimately, it's Otter Tail's decision on what lighting system to implement. The FAA is currently reviewing the LIDS solution. I think the Maricourt project has the latest deadline of 2021 for the lighting solution, and we expect completion of construction in Q3 of 2020. So ultimately, it's Otter Tail's decision on what to install, either ADLS or LIDS if approved. But I know just a general comment, multiple vendors, is that flexibility, going back to the point earlier, is appreciated.
These will be confusing for the public because they're expecting all new ones to be using the new lighting system from day one. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And it was permitted prior to the date when that was required. So we'll have to work with Otter Tail on some communication on that.
Right.
If they can't get it up by the operational time.
Correct. Yeah.
So anyway, just thinking out loud here.
And the LIDS system is where they flash all night. They're just not as bright on a clear night. They just flash bright enough to be seen for the right distance, correct?
It's a dimming. It's a dimming solution, yeah.
Well, that'll be good to have that approved if they're going to do that. So there's options.
Agreed.
Does that take it down to, is it like a 10% of visibility or from 100 down to 10?
I don't want to speak out of turn. I couldn't get back to you on the exact percentage. It sounds in the ballpark, but I'm not sure of a specific.
It's all based on the visibility,
right.
So any time in between there. But you're wondering what the lowest is.
Yeah.
Okay.
We'll try not to create too many homework assignments.
Sure. No problems.
Okay. Who's next?
I'm Brenna Gunderson with Apex. We just have early stage development projects, and we are planning to move forward with ADLS as long as it's approved and
good.
It's available.
Is anyone seeing the cost on that? Is it constant, or is it, you believe it'll decrease over time?
Well, I hope it decreases over time.
Right, right.
I think we're looking at upwards $1.5 million, somewhere in that range.
And how many turbines would that be retrofitting? How many? Well, not even retrofitting, but equipping how many turbines?
Julie might have a better answer on that. I'm thinking it probably around, I don't know how many turbines, but 250 megawatts, somewhere in
okay,
there.
Okay, so sure. I'm just trying to think on a per-turbine basis, what's the cost, and I know it. Whether you do one or 100, you have certain fixed costs up front, mm-hmm. but then you have the per turbine after that.
Okay.
So at New Frontier, this is Jonathan Wilson with Capital Power. I didn't introduce myself before. At our New Frontier site that we developed last year, the costs are between $500,000 and $750,000 for the ADLS retrofit. I don't know specifically how many turbines are at that location. We could provide that, but that's a fairly significant capital expenditure. We know we have to do it. This isn't the only state that does it, and we anticipate future development sites like our Garrison Butte site to have that. But it is, you know, it's a material expense. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Who's next?
Clay Cameron, NextEra Energy. We currently have three operating projects that is the ADLS system is being installed on, and then we have one that's currently under construction, and that will also have the ADLS system installed as well.
Clay, can you tick off the ones that you're, it's the two south of Dickinson, right?
Yes. So Oliver 3 is the project. Brady 1 and 2.
Brady 1 and 2.
Is the operational project that is currently having the ADLS installed. And then Emmett's Logan is under construction, and that's going to have the ADLS installed as well.
And I know it's a Foxtail had it installed. That's a next. That's Excel's now. But
correct. And I understand that project is operational as well.
Yeah, or will be soon. And your Brady 1 and 2, when do you expect those to be live? And Oliver 3?
And before the end of this year.
Okay. You're going to give us a heads up when that is, right?
Yes, we'll notify you.
Thank you.
Yep.
Who's next? Anybody? Any more updates? Doesn't look like it.
Does anyone have a number, a figure on how many states require this?
Okay. South Dakota requires it now by law. Minnesota has started requiring it just as best practice. It's been a permit condition, but not actual. It's not in statute or rules or anything, like most things in Minnesota. So,
I would imagine if you anticipate as an industry that this is going to be widespread, you just bake it into the numbers and plan on it from the start.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, as we were discussing when the legislation, Chris Kunkel with Apex Clean Energy, as we were discussing when this legislation was being discussed and as the commission was considering rulemaking on this, the flexibility is important. And I think that's been clear throughout this process because it's more complicated than just the state requiring it, right? We have to go through the FAA approval process, which is all done one-off. And so, you know, just allowing that process to play out. And I think that's exactly what's happening right now. So I think we're in a good spot. There's also complications. Maybe Brennan could speak more to this, but complications with just availability of the technology and a lack of vendors in this space. And so, you know, if you have hard and fast deadlines that don't allow for any flexibility, we're kind of scrambling because there's only so many of these you know, the actual companies that are producing this technology available, it's difficult to keep up with the market. And I think, to Brenna's earlier point, like hopefully that changes as demand grows and more states and projects are asking for this. But as I understand it, that's kind of the lay of the land right now.
Chris, you mentioned South Dakota. I wasn't aware of that. Do they offer the option both for ADLS and LIDS?
Correct. Yeah, that was I'm almost positive I can confirm this, but I'm almost positive that the language in their statute mirrors what you guys have up here where it's a light mitigation technology or something like that. So it's not specific to one technology, but rather the broader to allow for different types of technologies.
Then am I guessing right that it's a situation where it's for new development and then at some point the existing ones should adopt the same technology, or do you know about
question.
That?
Question. Do you know, or Peter, do you recall?
Is it prospective, Julie?
Yeah, it's only forward-looking.
Yeah. Julie Volk, NextEra. As I recollect, South Dakota did not allow for other technologies other than aircraft detection lighting. I say that because that was something that we were seeking, and that did not get in, is my recollection. My recollection is also that it's not; it only applies to future projects and not projects that are already built, at least the legislation that passed earlier this year.
Has the commission seen, so the statute and the rule allow for an extension for technical or economic feasibility, essentially? Has the commission seen any requests for those that you're aware of?
Not yet.
We have received requests for extensions, I believe, and I believe that was from NextEra. That might have been as a result of the order opposed to actual statutory change, though. And at that point, I think they provided us a timeline, and we were agreeable to that timeline for the update.
Yeah, the original order for the Brady, I think, said the end of year of 2018. And there was approval issues and availability issues and a number of things. So, yeah.
Julie Volk with NextEra. So one of the challenges, and Chris from Apex referred to this already, is for those of us that would like to consider other technologies that aren't approved yet, the timing of when you make your selection matters. And so we had been kind of waiting for the dimming technology to be approved by the FAA, and that's still in the approval process. So we had to go ahead and make some decisions on technology, but with limited vendors and the industry looking to add lighting mitigation, that creates some challenges that we need to balance. So that's something that we're kind of working through as an industry. So As states require this as a element of building future projects, we're hoping that there will be future additional commercial options that are out there for us to consider as this grows in our industry.
Good. Great. I appreciate the industry, like you guys, moving forward with what was available then. There is a balance there, I get, but also there's the balance of the public, and in that case, those folks, and it was a very controversial project, and there's people down there who really dislike it, and the promise was these lights aren't going to be on forever. They're going off, and we gave them a date, and that date was missed. So we already, not just us, but government, the industry in general, already has not met their expectations. And so perfectly understandable in this case. I mean, you do your best. It's brand new. It's new. So I don't fault anyone, but I'm conscious of that we want to make good on our word and do what we say we're going to do and in a timely manner. So thank you for not waiting, because we'd still be waiting for lids. So, yeah, that's the challenge of being on the front end of things.
And just to confirm, I pulled up the South Dakota statute, and Julie was correct. It does say aircraft detection lighting system, and it's only for projects that receive a permit after July 1st, 2019.
So question for whoever wants to answer it, but I don't know what the other potential solutions are besides ADLS or LIDS, but whatever they are and LIDS, what's the potential benefit to that, to those solutions as opposed to ADLS? Because I'll tell you, if once ADLS becomes acceptable to FAA, my own opinion is it's so much better of a solution than just dimming them down. I mean, you dim them down, and well, now you've solved the problem for somebody 15 or 20 miles away on a clear night. Probably don't have to look at them anymore. But everybody within some radius of it still has to look at them all night, as opposed to ADLS, where it's only if there's an aircraft within the whatever that distance is. And so what's the benefit to the other solutions?
Yes. One, I'm going to say, just from my perspective with the Air Force, I'm hoping that LIDS will be the alternative that allows there to be some light mitigating technology used in the areas where they don't want on and off. And so I'm hoping that that might provide a compromise in those areas. But beyond that, I'm with you. I think the ALDS is preferable because it's dark sometimes.
I'd agree with Andrew Dallin with EDF Renewables. I agree with the points that the commissioner made. And again, the flexibility of vendor selection is several others in the industry have mentioned, the difficulty of finding vendors and technology if we're narrowing the band of what is acceptable. And then to close the loop on my earlier homework assignment, heard back that the percentage, the lower band on the percentage, is exactly what the FAA is reviewing of just how what that appropriate dimming is. So that lower if it's 10% or whatever the percentage is what partly what the FAA is currently evaluating on what's appropriate.
All right. Good job. Does he get extra credit for getting back before the meeting was over?
No, we take it's a demerit because he was on his phone.
That's tough.
That's worth extra credit. Absolutely.
You get one from each of us and one away from him, so you're still up one.
Who's counting?
Yeah, these are worthless points anyway. Sure. So.
I have a question.
No value.
Brenda Gunderson with Apex. What's the timing of getting the approval for ADLS?
Well,
the commitment
can
be there to do it at the time of operation, but through the application process, is it expected to be approved when the application is submitted?
We don't say. We say that it needs to be operational by the time you go live. So when it gets approved, I guess, is kind of up to you guys. We don't specify that.
So going through the regular standard FAA process, for instance, with the standard lighting system to get the approval for the height and the locations is acceptable through the application process?
It seems like companies are doing both at the same time, but I guess I maybe that's an assumption that I've made, that they're doing the lighting process and saying we want this to be a DLS.
Well, I think that that takes
separate
involving and, you know, the consultant and, you know, potentially going through a process that we may not be prepared to go through yet at the time of knowing that we need to do it and to make the commitment. But
well, I guess I think it's up to you guys to just do it when you need to do it, to have it ready to go when you start operating.
Okay.
Do you see that differently? I mean, no. I don't know how to prescribe when you need to do that because I don't know the FAA timelines and, you know, it doesn't seem like they're always the same either.
I do have another lighting question, though, for whoever can educate me. So we build these large structures and we all know they need lights, but I don't know when that kicks in. At what height does it start to be that lighting is required, and then how does that work during the construction phase? Is it just a hard and fast FAA thing that once you get up to a certain level that then during the night they need to be operational until your mitigation system is all done? Or how does that work during construction?
Clay, do you have an answer to that?
Clay Cameron, NextEra Energy. Commissioner, so the FAA triggers a light on a structure over 200 feet.
200. Okay.
Correct. So at our Emmons Logan Wind Project, we do not have full grid power yet. So what we are doing when we fully erect a turbine, we are installing a temporary FAA-approved light that is lit all the time at night on every structure.
So that's not a flash, and
it's just a light that's lit full time. And it's a solar-powered LED light. It's a FAA-approved lighting light as well. So until we get full grid power, which is backfeed, we're able to, provide power to that ADLS light, that's what goes on. And a notification has to be sent to the FAA every time a turbine is erected to its full height as well.
And then as you work on construction, it just keeps moving up.
Correct.
So it's done.
That's correct.
Okay.
Do pilots... So you have a tower that is 250 feet, say, and then the turbine blades go up another couple hundred feet. So the lights at the top of the turbine blade, how do the pilots know that they can't cut it too close, that the blades are still going higher, because there's not lights on the end of the blades. So,
Barry, you want to answer that question?
I don't have an answer.
I mean, that's a great question. I don't have an answer on, but I assume if you're a pilot and you see a red on light, you're going to avoid that structure, right? I would assume so. If you can't see it at night, but you're right. It's at the top of the nacelle. It's not at the tip of the blade, that light.
Right, but thank you for clarifying the construction phase.
Brian has a very technical answer for that.
Fear of death.
Yeah.
Make sure you evaluate and review your flight plan very carefully and have the proper altitude when you're going over tall structures.
All right.
It's a motivating factor, it's true.
Do we have any other, did I answer the question that you asked? Maybe I misunderstood you.
No, I think you did. Okay. I just wanted to make sure that, FAA approval was of the ADLS system did not have to be in place at the time of submitting the application.
Sure. Okay, that was what you
were. How long does that process usually take once you initiate that with the FAA?
I'm not entirely sure. We haven't really been through it yet.
Your concern that then this just stretches out the time period?
Well, it would stretch it out, and it will depend on potentially the owner of the project getting involved in that part of the process.
Does anyone have, is it a year? Is it 6 months? Is it longer?
Clay Cameron, NextEra Energy. The typical approval process by the time you submit your FAA approval is about 4 to 6 months.
Just on the ADLS?
Well, on the ADLS and the determination of no hazards on the height of your turbine.
Okay.
So the ideal situation would be submit everything at once, because that way it's a more expedited process if you submit everything at once. Now, you do have to get a viewshed analysis submitted from your vendor of your ADLS system prior to FAA submittal.
Because the FAA process is going to be approximately 4 to 6 months anyway, mm-hmm. you know, just for the standard lighting system. And, of course, that depends on other factors, too, but that's, you know, generally. So going back and just having the lighting system approved is what I'm referring to, that there are definitely cases where we have gone through the system. We know that the location of the turbine is acceptable with the standard lighting system, and then it's getting the vendor involved to create the design, if you will, of the ADLS system for that particular project. So, you know, going back to them and just having that portion of it approved.
Yeah.
I don't know enough about it, but when you think about dimming it, and if it's down to 10% of what you would normally visually see or whatever the figure is, there's still going to be completely lit if an aircraft approaches, correct?
On lids.
On lids? I don't know a lot about lids. Mm-hmm. We have not looked into that.
But then it'll, you know.
But it sounds like it would be just the turbines would have.
They seem
not,
similar.
And it's usually not every turbine either, right?
Right.
But it's a, you know, prescribed, it's a such and such a distance from, depending on the mm-hmm. spacing of the turbines and. So that's what the FAA is looking at from the standard lighting system, is which turbines are you planning to light, and then approving that.
What I think I understood Clay to say is that they're doing it all together. They're not doing a standard lighting system, then coming back and getting the
right.
ADLS, which I guess I assumed that companies would do it all in one. Like, here's where we want them, here's our layout, and we want to use ADLS, so can you look at us and get us all of that approved? Mm-hmm.
And I think from our standpoint, we've gone through the development process on projects where ADLS wasn't maybe the rule changed, I guess, partway through. Mm-hmm. And so we had already submitted the application, or you're sort of done with development activities. And so we did not go back and contract with a vendor to go through that. You know, we went through the standard FAA process, got the approvals for the locations, and it would also depend on the timing of when you get your permit to when you're actually planning to have the project operational. It could be a span of time that, you know, more vendors, more, you know, things would change, and you might go back and want to redo your lighting plan anyway, depending on what the availability is and costs, manufacturers.
I believe it's set out in our rules and statute. It does allow for an extension for technical and economic reasons, generally. Mm-hmm. So if it does come up to that period of time, I think there we actually laid out what would be required to be provided to us for an extension, and that can be provided, and the Commission can make a determination upon that.
Okay. Yeah. I would say at this point, with this much notice, though, I would strongly urge you to have it done prior to operation, just because there's going to be projects that are up and running with it, and it's going to be an expectation that this is how that's done. And I think there's enough, you know, there's enough time. Even if you started today and submitted it, you're not going to probably be operational for 6 months. To get through that FAA process. So I would urge you to get that piece rolling on anything that you're intending to submit a permit for in the not-too-distant future. All right. Are we done with lighting? Then the next fun one.
We're enlightened.
Thank you for all the enlightenment you provided.
Okay, so transmission capacity and growth. I think you guys were going to talk about this too, right?
Yeah.
Thank you, Beth, if you want to kind of take the point at that.
Sure.
Thank you.
Thank you, Levi, and thank you, commissioners, for spending time with us this morning. I do have a leave behind. I've pulled some materials together that I'll leave for you to peruse afterwards. But just I was looking around the room trying to think how many people have been in this working on some of the opening comments I was going to make. And I think Jerry's probably somebody who has been around as long as I've been working on this. For those of you who don't know Clean Grid Alliance, we were formerly Wind on the Wires. And when we were launched in 2001, one of the first things we did was understand that the Dakotas, and North Dakota in particular, was going to be somewhere that people wanted to develop because of your resource. And so we very early on worked with the Lignite Council and with the Western Area Power Administration and all the other utilities to look at how do we export from North Dakota and what kind of transmission was needed. And so we did a number of activities early on, knitting together all those pieces with Lignite. We had studies that looked at 500 megawatts of coal with 50 megawatts of wind. What did we need to enable that kind of mix? And so my point is we have a long history of working with the other technologies and fuel types in North Dakota to find common ground on things that that we can move North Dakota forward on. And so obviously both in SPP and at MISO, you've got a lot of planning and a lot of activity underway. You've got some commonalities with the interconnection queues being very full mm-hmm. and transmission upgrades of significant costs coming out of those studies for groups of projects. And then you've got both power pools or RTOs, ISOs looking at what's next. So for MISO, we've come through the multi-value project portfolio. Those are, for all intents and purposes, that capacity is subscribed. So particularly in the west part of MISO, there is no transmission capacity left. We built to accommodate state goals and requirements. Utilities have procured projects or done PPAs to really use up that capacity. And the studies we're seeing come out both from MISO but also from SPP for the affected system studies are in the tens to hundreds of millions of dollars of upgrades required by interconnection customers. And so I've done this for 19 years, so we're kind of in this 20-year cycle of plan and, study, identifying what needs to be done, build, and now we're starting that loop again. The drivers are different this time, but nonetheless, there are significant drivers for wind. North Dakota is starting to see some solar development. When you look at whether it's the SPP states or the MISO states, there are goals and projections of what utilities want to do in the future. There are corporate customers who want access to low-cost renewables. All of this needs to be done in the frame, in my mind, of reliability, cost-effectiveness, and then accommodating the goals and desires of the end user. And so how can we plan the next tranche of the system to really meet all three of those benchmarks? That's kind of what we did with the MVP portfolio. And SPP had their build-out. I can't remember. It was the X lines or the X. They had something.
CapEx.
X build-out, or I can't remember what the name of their portfolio was. But they had something similar they did looking at the drivers.
Oh, SPP.
So,
Beth, I'm sorry to interrupt, but what was the third driver you listed?
So, reliability.
Oh, reliability.
Cost-effective, low cost, and then, the policy drivers or the goals and requirements that states have. MISO and SPP are both at different stages of planning. As you well know, there's a lot of planning in different buckets that's going on in MISO and in SPP. And one other thing that we're seeing for the industry is So you've got the longer-term MTEP, MISO Transmission Expansion Plan. SPP has something similar. That's kind of reliability-based, and it has a 15-year planning horizon. Then you've got MISO's looking at market efficiency projects. How do we relieve congestion? How do we make megawatts flow better across the system to get low-cost power to customers in higher-cost areas? And then there are a number of public policy goals that that are drivers as well. So what we're seeing right now, what the industry is seeing, is kind of a very siloed approach to planning. And whatever process gets to the finish line first, that's who pays, you know, on those projects. And so we're seeing this mismatch between the interconnection process finishing first and identifying really high-cost transmission upgrades that a project or a group of projects are being asked to pay for. It's exactly what we saw last time, and it's not sustainable because you can't have a group of projects pay $500 million for a 345 transmission upgrade. The interconnection customers may be willing to pay and are willing to pay their fair share, but a 345 kV, for example, that a group of interconnection customers are being asked to pay for provide many more benefits to the system than just interconnecting a generator or a group of generators. So the cost allocation is misaligned. So the planning process and the cost allocation right now are, things just have changed, and we need to reevaluate what we need to do going forward. So I guess my chief message today here is, let's be partners at SPP and MISO to figure out what we need to do next. And commissioners, I know you're both very active in that process. And you know, you see the day-to-day struggles that MISO has and SPP has. But for all intents and purposes, MISO West is very close to business from an interconnection standpoint due to these large upgrades. And if states really want to see the value, the economic development, the jobs, the being able to meet demand for this product, we need to figure out what's next in transmission. So that's my really quick elevator speech, and glad to answer questions.
Thank you, Beth. I appreciate the chance to talk to you guys about this because I'm hearing this over and over again through MISO and then in response with projects here that too have been affected very significantly that I'm aware of, and I'm sure that you guys could tell me more stories. But what does this mean? So what does it mean as it relates to development in North Dakota for the next 3 to 5 years?
I think that's a great question, and kind of just to build on what Beth said, and I'm well aware of how engaged, you know, you guys are in these conversations. North Dakota has a tremendous amount to gain in this, right? I think we heard it at the conference yesterday from the governor on down of the state being an energy powerhouse for the region, being a net exporter, and the opportunities that that provides. Without giving away anything too terribly competitive, we're not really looking at new wind sites in North Dakota. There's just no room on the transmission system. You know, we're looking at states that are much closer to load, the Illinois, the Indianas, the Michigans, et cetera, in MISO. You know, that's in a state like North Dakota, you can hit a 50%+ capacity factor on a wind project. You can't do that in other places. You have a tremendous amount of support from landowners that want to take advantage of this. But yeah, the reality is you're just not going to see a lot of new wind sites being looked at when when we're seeing the amount of congestion on the system and the resulting upgrade costs that are being as Beth articulated. So it's created an environment that's, you know, it's really tough right now to justify investing in new developments in the state.
And how do you guys have a sense, or even just raise a hand, how many of you have projects that already have the interconnect that haven't been built yet? So, okay, there's a couple. Are there a few? Julie, I think you guys have a couple.
One of the issues, this is Jonathan with Capital Power, that we're facing, if you have a queue position that you filed after 2017, you're caught in a queue backlog, and it's mm-hmm. and it's hard to get your GIA at this point. It's a very delayed process. And generally, when you hit the next milestone and you get a sense of what your assessed network upgrades are going to be, that's when you leave the queue.
Right.
And market the project to somebody else who's willing to take on that risk. And so I think moving forward, there'll probably be fewer and fewer developers who can answer that question with, I have my GIA, here's my expected upgrades, I'm filing my mm-hmm. siting permit moving forward. I think our project in the Stanton area, we had initially planned it for a 2022 operational date, and that's been delayed, I think, a year at this point now, and we're hoping a Q1 2023 operation date for that project, but we can't proceed in quickly enough through the queue to even get to our system impact study results where they could even assess how much our network upgrades are going to be. We now kind of expect that in the first quarter of next year, at which time we'll kind of decide the viability of our project over the next few years moving forward. And so a project that we anticipated doing all of our surveys and working with the local community to finalize our site designs and be ready to file with you guys this summer has been delayed to next summer and will likely, if we believe the recent attrition rates in MISO West, it probably won't make it. To be honest, and it's a shame because the resource is really great. We like doing business here in North Dakota. We've done one project. We plan to do another. We have enough land control and room to do even a second phase to this development project. I think the interconnection situation will mm-hmm. dampen our ability to participate in North Dakota moving forward.
Yep.
That also extends to mergers and acquisitions, which is most of my activities. I generally won't look at a development site in this region that didn't have a queue position filed prior to 2017.
Just a few more factors, if I may, Beth. So Holt for Clean Grid Alliance. So in the last cycle, for the West, the February 2017 phase two cycle, the numbers that came out of that second phase of planning, there were 3,000-5,000 megawatts that started in that planning cycle. When you get to as you move through the phases, there's more and more that you have to put at risk. Mm-hmm. And so that you get to a point where, you know, you risk it all. But at phase two, out of those number of megawatts that started, there were only two projects that went forward for a total of 250 megawatts. Mm-hmm. So a 200 megawatt project in Iowa and a 50 megawatt solar project. That's it. All the others, their upgrade costs were so significant that they, you know, are dropping from the queue, looking for other alternatives, interconnection points. So that's kind of the magnitude of where we're at.
Yeah.
And those are projects that have contracts for customers that are in permitting, may even hold a site permit from a state. Mm-hmm. You know, these are fully baked projects that are getting at where there's been a lot of really smart engineers looking at what to expect from upgrade costs, and then they're 10 times what, you know, what different people looked and anticipated. And so it's a really difficult environment in MISO West.
There are projects that have been, that haven't been constructed yet, that have an interconnect agreement, though, correct? I mean, there are some that I know for sure that, because BRC had an interconnection agreement and that project went away, but I understand there's going to be a new filing. So Julie, do you have a sense for how many?
I do. Julie Volk with NextEra. So we filed an application for a project in Burke County that did not receive approval. We are in the process of reorganizing that project and expect to file again with some relocation of some of the turbines that were problematic. And there is an interconnection to SPP that's already been approved. So we expect that should we get final approval for that, that interconnection will be utilized for that. So that's already approved for that particular project. With respect to the analyses that the RTOs have been doing for interconnection with our projects, we were affected pretty significantly with the last queue results. My understanding is about 80% of the projects that withdrew were ours, and it's not just North Dakota. It's a MISO West issue. Transmission is a regional issue. So we had project in Minnesota that we withdrew. We had project pieces of projects in South Dakota, as well as a project in North Dakota, and the one that you may be familiar with or will be is that a piece of our Emmons Logan project, 100 megawatts, we withdrew. We actually had two interconnections that we had for that project. One was for 200 megawatts, the other was for 100 megawatts, and at this point in time, we don't have an interconnection for the 100 megawatts. So what's very disappointing for the company is, first of all, it was a significant financial impact for us not be able to do that. We also have a purchase power agreement for that 100 megawatts that we are no longer going to be able to fulfill with that project. So it's a significant issue for my company as well as the industry. And not to get into all the other elements, but a lot of it is not specific to the state. It's really how the ISOs do their processes, and I know that it would be very easy for me to veer off into that, which I won't, but I will say that with all the things that have gone on in the industry with a shift to other fuel sources and a need for transmission, MISO hasn't changed all of its processes on how it does things, and so we take a risk as an industry when we look at future sites with this big unknown with whether we're going to be able to get interconnection. And in the case of what's happening with MISO, they also have to look at affected system studies. So it's not just even the RTO where you're building, it's what's happening in the neighboring RTOs, and there's disagreement between industry and the RTOs how those affected system studies are done, because for any of you that know how transmission planning works, it's very complicated. There's a lot of assumptions, a lot of modeling, and how those assumptions are taken into account really matter. So I'll stop there, because otherwise it could just go down another path. But I think what you're hearing from all of us is that interconnection is a major issue for us, because if we can't get onto the transmission system, we can't get our product to our customers, and it's just not going to allow us to continue to build without additional transmission or transportation to get the product out to the customers.
Well, I know Randy is real involved in the discussions that are happening in SPP. I'm very involved in MISO through OMS. There's a number of things going on. You know, there's the mid-grid effort that North Dakota is very actively engaged on, both our office, the governor's office. There's the MISO traditional planning things. Several subcommittees of MISO are dealing with this as well. So, yeah, I think that there's going to be a lot of solutions thrown out and discussed, and I'm interested in your input to me directly as this moves, if you have some insights, because it is a really technical issue, but you have to be able to understand the technical side in order to come to good solutions, so please don't hesitate to share your information with me.
Commissioners, if I could just add, I think it'd be really easy to just say, oh, we have this huge problem and kind of leave it there, but what do we do about it is really kind of where we need to go. And so I think, you know, number one, the state of North Dakota and the kinds of investment and opportunity that are being left by the wayside, you know, the state needs to really signal what you want to have happen in the state kind of writ large and what kind of infrastructure grid is needed to be able to do that. You know, that would be number one in my book is, you know, help SPP and MISO have a vision of where you want to go. You know, secondly, I think there are all of these studies are coming up with the same limiters Cooper South in SPP is a huge limiter that shows up in every study. And so we've been through enough cycles now where I think if you really ask the technical folks without all the politics, what's the next right set of candidate lines to look at from all the studies and all the things you know about from the local system? Put those on paper, feed them into MISO and or SPP, and say, can we look at some of these? And then what MISO does, if they get that input from everybody, from all the engineers, again, take out the politics and come up with a beneficial portfolio that is optimized for the states and the region to accomplish what they want to do. I mean, in a nutshell, that's what needs to happen. And we have to go through these twists and turns with the various buckets and silos. And, you know, the other, I think it comes down to two simple things. What do we build and who pays? It's not, you can't make it any simpler than that. So the who pays part, you know, industry has said, we're willing to pay our fair share. We're willing to look at different cost allocation if we get commensurate benefits. And so we're going to be very willing to be at the table and lead on what that cost allocation looks like. Because until we figure out what that looks like, we don't have a solution. But I think that the leading technical work that can be done to really show here's a portfolio that provides X benefits based on what the states want, based on you know, reliable, cost-effective, reaching goals that the states have is kind of motherhood and apple pie and where we need to go. Gets a lot more complicated after that, as you guys well know.
Yeah. That's the dilemma with allocation of these things.
Yeah.
It's easy to, and Julie summed it up the best, when it comes to allocation, it gets complicated.
Yeah.
Probably enough said right there, but when people talk about willing to pay their fair share, I think everybody comes into these discussions saying they're willing to pay their fair share. There's different have opinions of what fair is.
Yeah.
And their fair, their definition of a fair share is usually someone else paying more than what someone else thinks is a fair share. And well, so...
Yeah, let me be a little less really cryptic.
Complex.
You know, I think we're committed to the current MISO tariff, and I'm not as familiar with SPP, but the current MISO tariff does not allow for creative solutions. There, you know, the tariff is very, it's not flexible. And so part of what we think needs to happen is as we put together this coalition of the willing, we're going to have to look at tariff changes and making a filing that enables cost allocation a different way. And I think we have to go through some of the ProMod work and some of the cost-benefit analysis for the portfolio. But right now what we're seeing is that the tariff is somewhat in the way. And so I think we need to be able to signal to MISO and SPP that the solution might not be in the current tariff products. It's going to probably require new thinking and filing at FERC, justifying why we want to do this a different way.
I appreciate that, Beth. One of the issues that I've had is I feel that the tariffs unfairly burden the people who are hosting the new generation. And so I can't be for that. Our customers can't bear the brunt of costs for power that's going someplace else. Part of it, yes, recognizing the benefits we get.
Yeah.
But it is not fair to spread those costs on North Dakota customers just because we have a good wind resource here. So that's where, I mean, when you start seeing everybody get testy, that's kind of what starts happening and things break down. But I hear you saying, I think, let's break out of the traditional tariff and get into some more creative ways. I mean, another creative example that I'm thinking is, do you guys just say MISO, SPP, we don't care about you because our customers are in PJM and we're going to build our own line to PJM and we're going to pay for it ourselves and charge those customers out there. We're clamoring for wind.
Yeah.
I mean, those are other solutions that I think the industry, if I'm you and looking at this great wind resource and customers out east who are dying for renewable energy, how do I circumvent this cumbersome MISO process?
Yeah, and I think people are certainly looking at that. We've had Clean Line, we've had, you know, Sue Green mm-hmm. that is looking, and I know there are other people who have ideas. Again, really easy to say, really hard yep. to do, to weave through the tariff and figure out all the pieces, yeah. but I'm positive that we're going to figure it out.
Good.
As I've reviewed and studied and gone through this, because one of the questions I had, and it relates to a project in North Dakota where the interconnect cost, was it Burke? Not Burke, Russo. Is that the right one, the $500 million
yep.
interconnect price tag? So I started making phone calls because I wanted to know. So I called various representatives of various organizations and you know, being careful, of course, not to dive into the specifics of the case, but just how could you be so surprised? And I don't mean this in a bad way, but mm-hmm. so you're estimating that this is going to cost X amount. And I'd gotten those numbers on what it was expected to cost. And then when it comes in substantially higher, $500 million, there just has to – I'm trying to still get my arms around, okay, so – and this isn't a negative to the industry, but it does beg the question, well, how could this be – how could this happen? Why was it so surprising? And where was the communication breakdown, if you will, or – or was it just the fact that everyone was trying to get on essentially at the same time because of deadlines?
We'll say. Commissioner, you ask a great question. And I think it points to a couple of things. We've been saying for a couple of years we're going to hit this point. But really, until you get the SETI results and realize it's not a in the future anymore, it's here today, you know, then it is what it is. I think whether it's in our member industry companies or at utilities or other places, there's a chain of messaging up that doesn't always happen sometimes. I think the visions that utilities and others have put out there, it's great, but we need to figure out how we're going to implement on that. And, you know, vision's great, but implementation's even better. And so I think there's a variety of reasons. But one thing we know is that we're seeing this cycle over and over now, especially in MISO West. And I think as people move their projects to other parts of the MISO footprint, that's going to get saturated as well. And so it really is, it's time to figure out what's next. Why were they surprised? I think there's a variety of reasons.
Those are enormously complex analyses when these RTOs have dozens of projects in the queue, and every one impacts all the rest of them.
Yeah.
And so every time something changes, everything is impacted, and it is so complex. I can see, I also thought, it seems like a huge surprise how you could be that far off from what you were estimating, but seeing the amount of analysis that goes into that, I can easily see where someone's initial estimate can be pretty far off.
So I will just also say, you know, there was in your handout, there's a line that was identified as needed for congestion relief, and that line was supposed to go in MTEP 19, the Helena to Hampton Corners line. Because interconnection customers were paying for upgrades, those were put in instead of that congestion relief line. And so, again, it's which process is finishing first? And so are we not investing in transmission that is really beneficial, but yet doing the Band-Aid approach through the interconnection process? So I think that gets us back to we need to fix this bigger planning process and figure out, you know, what's next, what are we going to study, and how do we move it forward? Speaking for the industry, I think we're very worried that it's going to take us 10 years to figure this out, and how do we keep things going? So my another part of my elevator speech has been the engineers have solutions to the low-hanging fruit or the next right thing to build. Can we get those in the process? Can we make business cases for utilities who want to invest and get some of these things going forward? Because the industry is not going to survive, whether it's wind or solar, you know, with 2 years to figure out the process, 3 years to study, 2 more years going through FERC, getting the process approved, 2 years in the state approval process, and then 3 years for construction. I mean, that's exaggerated, but that's what we're looking at. And so whether it's double circuiting, whether it's novel solutions, whether it's new technologies like storage, whether it's whatever, we have to figure out how to be able to move faster. And if anybody wants to chime in, go for it.
Hi, Julie Volk with NextEra. So I'd like to get back to Commissioner Krosh's question from the perspective of our company. I can't speak to any other projects, but in the latest queue where the vast majority of the projects pulled out, I think the Russo project was in there, I'm not certain, but at least for us, the estimates of what we had for interconnection cost system upgrades associated with those wasn't far off from what we estimated them to be. And what we do, and I expect others do this as well, is we model the MISO system and all the other RTOs as well, and we work with MISO to get the inputs. They make that information publicly available, and so we try to come up with the same solutions that they will. That wasn't the issue for our projects. The issue for us was the affected system studies that other RTOs do, and in this particular case, it was the SPP affected system. And there's been some conversation this morning about what all went into that, and I don't have specifics myself today, but the impacts of that affected system study were far greater than we expected, and I think there was some differences in assumptions in that modeling, and as Commissioner Christman already alluded to, it's very complicated. These are significant computer models. So we've been pretty close in what we think interconnection costs are going to be for our projects working in RTOs in general. It's just that there, because capacity's filling up on systems, the assumptions and congestion on neighboring systems matter. And we never anticipated that we, at this point in time, would be pulling projects out of a queue. We've been a proponent for putting rules in place for the queue that don't allow projects to, what I'll call, squat or sit there. Only, you know, projects that are going to go forward should stay in the queue. So we had no intention whatsoever of pulling projects out of the queue. And unfortunately, that's where we find ourselves. And it's distressing because the processes out there that are in place make it challenging for us and others to just kind of go forward. So hopefully that at least gives you a window into why they could be so far off, because it happened to a number of us. At least in our case, it was the affected system studies.
I think if I could put a bow on that part of this conversation, I think it's really important that North Dakota's leadership is very important in the process because of the two RTOs, but also you're one of the states that show load growth. Mm-hmm. And so those lost business opportunities will be more acute here than in perhaps other states. And so groups like CGA and AWEA will put together a process where we can bring stakeholders together to communicate to the RTOs that we have solutions that are meaningful, but it also takes them to act. And so we can be helpful in that process, and we believe North Dakota's voices are going to be very important in that because of those factors. So we're here to help.
Don't ever hesitate if you're coming forward with ideas to, you know, give me a heads up directly, and then I can have a clue before OMS starts talking about it. That'd be great.
Well, and hopefully for any type of generating source, because this has a ripple effect across all of them. You know, and I understand, and I know it's very, very complicated. But my first thought is then figure out a way to make it a little less complicated. Because if it just, you know, always ends up as really complicated, basically that tells me it's a guessing game.
Brian, you need to be nominated for the board at MISO.
So that would be my back when I used to do my board presentations, that would have been one of my punchlines in the speech. Then you have to make it less complicated. And then people would look at me like, you have no idea what you're talking about. And
less complicated equals those PowerPoints that they put out all the time.
So, no, I just think that,
you know, for the, you know, I mean, this we're talking about the grid. We're talking about delivering power to businesses and households every single day, 24/7, every second of the day. And, you know, it's troubling when I start to look at this particular issue in terms of trying to model what costs will be, and then wondering where are we going to be in 5 years or 10 years from a reliability standpoint, because it's all intertwined.
Okay, so that's been a good discussion, and there'll be a lot more discussion on that in the future. So the last topic is military siting overview, and this came out of literally nowhere the other day at our hearing. I couldn't have been more surprised. I thought they were getting up to talk about the rules that we had proposed, and they came up with a whole new rule, a very potentially substantial one. So,
Julie,
Jack, do you want to talk about your conversations with them, and then we can get feedback from the industry?
I guess I just want to preface this discussion. I received this agenda right before I walked in here, and since this is an open rulemaking, all our considerations are supposed to be limited to what we received in our comments up to that deadline point. And also, we didn't notice this, and to probably have as broad a discussion as I think you guys were hoping to have today, we probably would have had to make a determination, some determination today, which we haven't adequately probably provided a notice for it. But to the extent that I think that parties and our interested stakeholders are here today and they provided comments, I know they have. I know NextEra and Mr. Kunkel, I think your group did as well regarding this matter. I'd be comfortable if they, I guess, reiterated their comments. But to the extent that we're really going to go really in depth into this matter and make commission decisions on that, I would have some concerns.
Well, okay, let me follow up,
Bill. I had the same concern when I seen the agenda.
What about... I mean, we have the rule on the pending rule, which is not really what we're here to talk about.
The commission hasn't made a determination on the scope of whether this could be incorporated into that or not. I know during the hearing on this...
We have to do to make that? I thought we made that determination.
Well, you guys discussed this but at the hearing individually as commissioners, but there was no actual commission decision during that hearing on whether or how to approach this moving forward. I feel that I know what you would like, but there wasn't an actual.
So what do we need, I guess, to do that, take that action? Is that a decision in a meeting?
Yeah, that would be a decision in the meeting, Commissioner, and that's where what we'd probably have to do to really open this up. But we didn't notice this with those case numbers as something that the commission would be making a decision on today, and that would be my concern with that.
Okay. Well, fine, but... And I know you're saying it's fine, Levi, but I think it's regretful because there's a whole room full of people that could provide really good feedback. And I wish we could hear from them. But
would it be okay if, say, a generator who built a project recently just speaks about how many turbines are within a couple miles, potentially, of one of these ICBM sites? No active docket, not making the comments on the rulemaking, but just how this would have impacted...
I think that would be fine. If you're just talking about projects, if you're talking about comments that we've actually received, and I think just, explaining what was sent out there, but to broaden that scope of what we received for the purposes of this rulemaking, that's where the concerns
are. Okay. Well, and we will be, I think we're all on the same page that we're going to have a separate rulemaking on this, so there will be an opportunity for you to provide input. And staff has been talking with the Air Force, too, so you can... conversations with the staff as well.
Commissioner, and I really appreciate this was a very last minute addition since it came up in the hearing. The idea was not to get into the weeds, but rather to make a commitment that Jeff in particular has an expert at AWEA that is very involved with the DOD clearinghouse process. And essentially we want to just simply make the commitment to you all that the industry already has a very developed process, and they're very interested in talking with the DOD generally and with the Minot Air Force Base representatives. Is that fair?
Yeah, Jeff? Yeah. Just a really broad overview. DOD Clearinghouse goes through the review process with the developers, with the affected military base, no matter where it is. This is active in quite a few states. And then there's a letter of mission compatibility. And so it's a work-with process that produces a work product that says the siting plan is actually in compatibility with what the military mission is for that particular base. So there is a process that's available to the commission that would maybe solve this problem rather than hard and fast site distances. And so that was really what the discussion was going to be today. And Chris and I were prepared to kind of answer questions about it. But if you have another process going forward, we're willing to work with you.
Did they not know about this process? The military people that came here asking for this? That's what's to me.
Yeah, so we
they
are.
Don't think that they must not know about it or it doesn't work for them.
We think it's a lack of the knowledge. There is autonomy at the local base level.
But these folks were not from North Dakota. They were out of Colorado. The military folks that showed up to testify were not just local folks.
Right. And so that's a part of the
conversation
to make sure that they're aware this is available through the DOD. So they may not have been aware of it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, that would be great.
Yeah.
I think there. So a couple things. I don't want to speak for the folks that were here a couple weeks ago, but I think what I heard at least was not necessarily a concern about turbines that are there today, but what does the future hold and how might this affect missions in the future? And so I think there just needs to be a better understanding across the board of how the clearinghouse process works, the fact that the whole intent of the reason the clearinghouse, DOD clearinghouse process was created was that so there was not a one-size-fits-all approach to siting turbines near military facilities, whether that's ICBM facilities, Air Force bases, MTRs, MOAs, whatever, that these are looked at a project-by-project basis, a base, with incorporating the input of local bases. And that's a process that there, as Jeff has mentioned, there's a ton of expertise in our industry about this. There's a number of consultants that do this around the country, have a ton of familiarity with the process that I do think can be helpful in this. And, you know, maybe it's not in this specific rulemaking, or if it's a formal process, that's fine. If it's more informal, you just want to have a conversation about, hey, how does this work? You know, what are you, when are you looking at this in your development process, that sort of thing. We want to be helpful however we can be. Just want to reinforce that commitment to help kind of, you know, navigate and provide input as you'd like it.
Okay.
Well, I think that's a pretty good overview from what you were looking for.
Does that work, Jay?
Maybe we've exhausted where we can go with that at this point.
But probably.
So the where to from here is?
We'll follow up.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Well, that's the end of our agenda. Thank you, everybody, for your participation and your candor. And hopefully it was productive for you guys. I know I learned a lot, and I think there's things to follow up on. And we'll have lots of ongoing work together.
Yeah, Levi, thank you for coordinating and getting the ball rolling.
Thank you for your time.
Nice work.
Much appreciated.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.